This is Ed Mazur, chairman of the City Club of Chicago. Our speaker today was Cardinal Blaise Supich, the Archbishop of the City of Chicago. Cardinal Supich began by saying that the summer of 2018 has been a summer of scandal for the Catholic Church. He asked a question right from the beginning: why should we trust bishops to do the right thing? He waded right into the sexual abuse scandal by clergy on the faithful. He said when he first heard about the Pennsylvania report, Pennsylvania Attorney General's report on sexual abuse in that area, he was filled with anger, grief, and shock over the abuse by clergy on the faithful. Many times, Cardinal Supich would say, abuse has no place in the church. There is no place for those who are abusers. He pointed out that civil authorities in Chicago are kept informed of all charges against clergy. The safety of children, the safety of parishioners, should be the number one priority of the church. Supich said that we must be vigilant. We must follow the policies that exist that the church has often chosen to ignore with regard to sexual abuse and clergy who are not doing what they have been trained to do. Bishops at all levels must be held accountable to abuse and its effect on the church. Then he moved beyond Chicago. He said abuse is truly a global problem, and bishops and the people who attend the churches should be very clear about where the church stands. He called for full transparency. He said no one can be exempt, and in any decision-making, the laity must become involved. The culture of privilege, he said, that has been held for many, many years by bishops and other members of the clergy must end. The number one priority, Cardinal Supich said, is the safeguarding of children. He completed his address by saying that zero tolerance is not negotiable. Lived values means that we have a culture of accountability and justice that follow what he called Christ's call. Priests and bishops, he said, must be viewed as the caretakers of God's mercy.
Good morning. It's good to be with all of you again. I think it was, what, 2 or 3 years ago that I was here first?
Yeah. Last year and the year before.
Okay, great. This August, just a few days after I issued a letter in response to the devastating revelations of the Pennsylvania Grand Jury report, Jay invited me to speak to the City Club on the abuse crisis, and I gladly accepted. I began my letter to the people of the Archdiocese with the only words that I could summon to capture the anguish in my heart at that moment: anger, grief, and shock. I have felt that before, and I want to tell you the first time that those feelings were seared into my heart. It was when I was the bishop of a mostly rural diocese. A successful middle-aged businessman came to see me. He had a heart-wrenching story. Starting when he was just 9 years old, serving Mass regularly on Sunday at his local parish, his priest had him stay afterwards, ostensibly to help clean up. But this man had a darker purpose. He would take this young 9-year-old boy into the church basement and sexually abuse him week after week. And then this priest, a man ordained to serve the people of God, would walk this 9-year-old boy home, hand in hand, and sit down to have dinner with the family. One day, he asked his mother, "What if Father asked me to do something that I don't want to do?" His very devout mother, thinking that her son was talking about avoiding chores, replied, "Whatever Father asks of you, you have to do." And so he did, for 4 agonizing years. Finally, the boy found the courage to tell his father what was going on, and the abuse ended. It was, as you might imagine, a profoundly painful thing to share. After the man finished telling me the story, I said, "What can I do for you? Tell me what you would like." He said, "I want to confront this priest. I want to lay this burden at his feet because I have carried it too long." And And so I had the man come in, and he was confronted. The priest did not deny it. And so I suggested to this businessman, a former 9-year-old altar boy, let me go to the parish and tell the people, because there are other victims. He said, fine, and I'm going to come with you. So after informing the police and sending the case to the Holy See, we visited the parish. I explained that their former priest, what he had done, and I invited others to come forward. Then I walked into the church vestibule and took down the photo of the priest that was hanging there. He could have no place in that church. And then I notified or visited the other parishes where this man had served and asked victims to come forward. It was a moment of great pain, but that victim survivor's courage forced me to grow up, to be an adult in a new way, a way that I had never experienced. That encounter convinced me that there can be no place in the church for leaders who misuse power or expect privilege and protection because of their status. I have carried that memory of that man for nearly 20 years through another diocese that was bankrupted by abuse scandal, and finally to here in Chicago, all these 3 decades, which for 3 decades the Archdiocese has been a leading and comprehensive actor in bringing about an end to this scandal. It has made many contributions, beginning in 1991 when Cardinal Bernardine convened a lay commission to review the Archdiocesan procedures for handling accusations of sexual abuse. The following year, the Archdiocese put in place policies and procedures to address allegations and issues related to this very searing issue. And in fact, in 1992, the year after, Cardinal Bernardine went to the annual meeting of the Bishops' Conference in Washington, and he presented the policies and procedures to his brother bishops. Unfortunately, not all accepted it. Had all the bishops at that time taken those policies home and implemented them fully, imagine how much further ahead we would be in preventing abuse and punishing perpetrators and offenders. But Chicago's efforts did not stop just with policies. Actions are needed more than words. The Archdiocese also dedicated significant resources over these years. It created the Office of Victim Assistance Ministry to provide direct outreach and support to victims and their families. We believe it was the first office of its kind in the United States. It also created an independent office, now known as the Office for Child Abuse Investigation and Review, to receive allegations of abuse of minors by clergy. This office is headed by lay professionals who provide a compassionate and thorough process for receiving and investigating reports of child abuse against archdiocesan personnel. But before they do any investigation, they notify civil authorities of all that information that comes to them. We do this regardless of what the legal requirements are for reporting. The director of that office also serves as staff for the Independent Review Board, which advises me on accused clerics' fitness for ministry. More than 230 recorded board meetings have been held over these years. Knowing that only prevention would stop this scourge, the Archdiocese also established the Office for the Protection of Children and Youth to bring together the various ministries within the Archdiocese dedicated to ensuring the safety of children and providing support to victim survivors. For instance, the Safe Environment Office oversees prevention efforts through training for adults and children and developing resources to educate archdiocesan clergy, employees, and volunteers on how to prevent sexual abuse of children, and how to recognize sex offender behavior, and how to create safe environments for children and youth. Since 2003, 263,000 adults have been trained in 3,700 training sessions. Archdiocesan parishes and schools are required to provide training also for children and youth. on how to recognize, but also to respond to and report grooming or abuse, no matter where it happens or who does it. Students receive age-appropriate training in each grade annually, and it instills in them a knowledge that they have a right to be safe, that they don't have to feel unsafe, and they have a right to report. Safe Environment Office personnel also screen through name-based background checks. All clergy, all employees, all volunteers have background checks. Office personnel also receive and review fingerprint results of school personnel. And if they don't pass, they don't get hired. We also have priest monitoring program for clergy who have substantiated cases of sexual abuse against them. These men are withdrawn from ministry, and they're prohibited from presenting themselves as a priest, even wearing any clerical garb. They're required to comply with numerous restrictions to ensure safety for the community. Even with these policies and structures, however, we have to be alert. Mistakes can and have happened. As the McCormick case in our archdiocese illustrates, we have to remain vigilant. We have to follow exactly the policies we say we have. By 2002, with the scandal in Boston hanging over the church, the Archdiocese of Chicago's 1992 principles helped to shape what's now known as the Charter for the Protection of Children and Young People. That was approved by the bishops in 2002 at a meeting in Dallas. I was present for that, a very young bishop at that time. The charter reinforced what the Archdiocese of Chicago had been doing for a decade by requiring all dioceses to do the following: to bring about healing, promote reconciliation of victim survivors and their families as the first priority, make prompt and effective responses to abuse allegations, cooperate with civil authorities, discipline offenders, create a safe environment for children and for young people through training and screening, provide means of accountability through an annual audit of the implementation of the Charter's requirements. Many people, understandably, have referred to the past few months as the summer of scandal for the Catholic Church. How, so many parishioners asked, could the Church find itself mired in scandal yet again? Not only over the abuse of minors and the bishops who failed to protect them, but also over the rise and the fall of a cardinal who had been accused of sexual misconduct with seminarians and minors. The bishops pledged to address this 16 years ago, they point out. What are the bishops doing now? Why should we trust them to do the right thing? As I wrote in my letter to the people following the Pennsylvania grand jury report, these are precisely the questions that ought to be asked. As a former chair of the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops Committee on the Protection of Children and Young People, I have asked them myself. Sorrow, disgust, and outrage. These are all righteous feelings. They are the stirrings of the conscience of a people scandalized by the terrible reality that too many of the men who promised to protect their children and strengthen their faith have been responsible for wounding both. Clearly, the answer to these questions must begin with holding bishops accountable, not only for any misbehavior, but also mishandling of cases, as we all promised to do 16 years ago. As many of you know, we bishops gathered in Baltimore earlier this month to take up the task of holding each other accountable through a series of proposals that would address these failures by bishops. What happened at the bishops' meeting has been widely reported. The president of the USCCB, Cardinal Daniel DiNardo, announced just before the meeting began on Monday that the Holy See had requested the bishops to refrain from taking any binding votes. The Vatican wanted us to wait until an unprecedented meeting of the presidents of the world's bishops' conferences on clergy abuse set for February in Rome. To be sure, our first reaction was disappointment. As we discussed the proposals, however, it quickly became clear that we would not be able to reach a consensus regardless of the Vatican's initiatives. In other words, the proposals presented to us were not mature, and we really didn't have enough time to weigh in on them beforehand, since we only got them from the conference 10 days before the meeting. For there also was wisdom in Rome's decision that we work with the bishops around the world. This is a global problem. We need to listen to each other as bishops as we gather through our presidents in February in Rome. Nevertheless, after Cardinal DiNardo's broke this news to the body of bishops, I decided to stand and make two recommendations. First, that the conference take a non-binding vote on the proposals at hand. I believe that it was important for us to be clear with our president where we stood, but also to tell our people where we stand as he prepares for the meeting in February. It was important for us to be able to discuss these issues in a way that was very frank and open. My second suggestion was that we move our next regularly scheduled meeting from June to March, so that we can act promptly on the reforms that will be discussed at the February meeting. Since the significant difficulties with the proposals put forth by the USCCB made it very unlikely that they would be adopted by the necessary two-thirds vote, I decided to put forth another idea for investigating accusations against bishops. The proposals, which came together with the help of about a half a dozen bishops, who really represented a spectrum of where bishops come on different issues, I thought we needed to bring about some consensus from across the entire spectrum. It was important, I believe, to make sure that the proposal that I put forward engaged in a significant way lay involvement, but also leveraged a regional province structure that the church already has in place in this country and throughout the world. As you know, we have what we call provinces, and for the most part, they're broken up by state, and they're overseen by a metropolitan or an archbishop. For instance, I'm the metropolitan for the other dioceses here in Illinois. According to my proposal, it would begin with a third-party system, such as the national hotline that the U.S. Bishops' Conference is already setting up. It would serve as a means for anyone to make an allegation against a bishop, whether of sexual abuse or mishandling cases of abuse. If the accusation involved criminal activity, local law enforcement would be notified by the third-party system. The allegation then would also be immediately referred to the chair of the Lay Majority Review Board of the local archbishop or metropolitan, but also to the metropolitan archbishop. If the metropolitan bishop himself is accused, then the allegation would be referred to the chair of the Lay Majority Review Board of the senior bishop in the province and also the senior bishop. One important thing that I wanted to make sure was that the proposal we presented had the force of law. The USCCB proposal had an opt-in or optional character to it. I thought we needed to expand the essential norms that were particular law for this country to include bishops. I realize that all of this may sound more than a bit arcane, but in fact, the metropolitan or provincial or local regional system that I proposed was really the reason the Archbishop McCarrick case came to light. Cardinal Timothy Dolan of New York was a metropolitan bishop of the region in which Archbishop McCarrick was alleged to have abused a minor. He reported quickly, publicly, that his review board had determined that the allegation was substantiated. It was also the case of Baltimore Archbishop Lurie, his response to the allegation against Bishop Michael Bransfield of Wheeling, which is in the province of Baltimore. Both Cardinal Dolan and Archbishop Lurie did their job. So we have proof of concept. I offered the proposal in the hopes that it might move our discussion forward in Baltimore and contribute to our follow-up after the February meeting of the presidents of the World's Bishops' Conferences in Rome. We bishops have to address forthrightly the degree to which we have kept the promises we made in 2002 with the adoption of the Charter. The bottom line is that the Charter works if we actually use it and implement it. I'm confident that the Archdiocese of Chicago is complying with these promises. In fact, I believe we go beyond them. Yet the Pennsylvania Grand Jury report brought serious doubt that all the U.S. bishops have kept their promises that we made in 2002, motivating civil authorities, including our own Attorney General, to investigate. Cooperating with such investigations, which seek to bring the terrible truths of abuse scandal into light, is something we bishops owe to all of our people, but we also owe it to our children. I'm resolved that we will deal effectively with this crisis, take the necessary steps to rebuild trust with our people, and build on the progress we have made to protect children. These steps include making it easier for victims to come forward with allegations against bishops and to ensure the independence of the review process, the third-party confidential reporting system being set up by the USCCB to handle complaints of sexual abuse of minors by bishops and also sexual misconduct with adults by bishops should be in place soon. We also must adopt policies to address restrictions on bishops who were removed or resigned because of allegations of sexual abuse of minors or sexual misconduct with adults. Likewise, we'll have to enact a code of conduct by bishops regarding the sexual abuse of minors and sexual misconduct with adults, including negligence related to such cases. I also believe it is important to have a full and independent investigation of allegations of misconduct with a minor by bishops, full transparency in making the findings public. No one can be exempt from accountability, and the laity must be involved in this process for full transparency. Finally, as the Holy Father has emphasized, the culture of privilege, self-protection, has to come to an end. The culture of clericalism, where some feel as though they have power, privilege, and protection that allows them to get away with crimes. We would do well to remember that when Cardinal Bernardine was accused of misconduct, he submitted himself to the archdiocesan review process. This was a painful moment for all, but his example speaks powerfully to us today. Last week, Pope Francis appointed me to the planning committee for the February meeting of the presidents of the world's bishops' conferences that he has called to address the abuse crisis. This meeting is unprecedented, and it reflects the Holy Father's commitment to safeguarding children as a fundamental priority for the global church. Like me, Pope Francis is motivated to take up this work of making major reforms, radical reforms, in large part by his meeting with victim survivors who bravely share their stories, their deep pain. He meets regularly with victims in the Vatican. By his own admission, he has learned a great deal from these encounters. He's been decisive in removing cardinals and bishops, laicizing some for misbehavior, removing bishops for their mishandling of cases. Pope Francis now wants all the church's leaders to have a full understanding of the devastating impact clerical sex abuse has on victim survivors, but also to accept ownership at a national, regional, diocesan, and parish level for effectively addressing this issue in a way that keeps all children safe. It was nearly 20 years ago when that middle-aged businessman recounted how he was abused by one of my priests. As he spoke to me, I heard the voice of a 9-year-old boy who, though deeply wounded, had the courage to come forward and share his story. I was humbled by his trust, and I still am today. The voice of the victim survivor must be the church's true north as we work to address this global scandal. Yes, ours is a church of many nations, many cultures, a diversity that we must respect. But zero tolerance when it comes to harming children and full accountability are non-negotiables. These are not values to be held in the abstract or simply codified as a list of procedures to be ticked off as a matter of routine. No, they have to be lived values. They must be values that permeate the very air we breathe as a church, so that everyone from the volunteer tutor to the bishop knows that building a culture of accountability, justice, and healing is essential to what it means to be church, to what it means to be a disciple, to what it means to follow Christ's call. Pope Francis put it powerfully in his address to victim survivors during his 2015 visit to the United States. This is what he says. He said, "The crimes and the sins of sexual abuse of children must no longer be held in secret. I pledge the zealous vigilance of the church to protect children and the promise of accountability for all. You survivors of abuse have yourselves become true heralds of hope and ministers of mercy. We humbly owe each one of you and your families our gratitude for your immense courage to shine the light of Christ on the evil of the sexual abuse of children. As a church, and especially as bishops, we must keep this promise. We must never abandon victim survivors. We must never grow complacent. We must confront the truth and act to bring healing and justice to those who have been robbed of both. The church stands as a sign of God's surpassing love, a love we Christians find in the person of Jesus Christ. This is a moment for all of us, for bishops especially, to mature in knowing who Jesus is. To the extent that we look into the face of the victim survivor, we look into the face of Jesus. Our prayer in this moment of sorrow and agony, disappointment and hurt, must be that the Lord now deepen the church's thirst for justice and healing, that we hold firm to our resolve to be the hands of God's mercy as we're supposed to be, reflecting with every step that we take God's love for his children. Friends, that is my prayer, confident and filled with hope that these too are gifts that God has always wanted to give his children. Thank you for listening.
Your Eminence, thank you very much for your remarks. Come up here, please, if you don't mind. We have a number of questions. If anybody else has some questions you would like to have us address, please hold up your card. Our staff will pick them up, and we'll try to handle as many of these as possible. The very first one is from Patricia Provenzano, who's affiliated with U.S. Trust. What is the Archdiocese doing to encourage young people to participate in the church? At Old St. Pat's, we have a vibrant younger community, but it is not one I have seen replicated at other parishes in the city.
We do have some very vibrant parishes that carry on the fine work that Old St. Pat's is known for, and they really do a fine job. The the outreach of the archdiocese is no doubt something that we do at a parish level, but on the archdiocesan level as well. We need to dedicate more resources to that, and we are. But one thing that I found in talking to young people, especially that group post-college, their lives are so very busy. They're thinking about their careers. Maybe some even are alienated because of the abuse scandal or some other reason. But one way that we do have them participate in the mission of the church is through our Catholic Charities. We have a large group of young people, maybe who are not regular churchgoers, who have generous hearts, who are involved in volunteer work, who are down at the soup kitchens feeding the poor, or helping at this time before Christmas to prepare gifts for those families that are in want. So I think that's a pathway for us. We need to tap into the generosity of young people. Rather than measuring their participation in the church, first of all, by mass attendance. I think this is so very important. I just came back from the Synod on young people. And I can tell you, I'm impressed, not only what I saw in the meeting, the Synod, but also in my dealings with young people here today. They have good hearts, and we have to in some way meet them there without any preconditions. And I think that's the way forward for us.
Thank you. We have some really good questions here, by the way. This is from Mark Carhoff with 10 Count Consulting LLC, City Club member. His question, Your Eminence, is, how can civic leaders bring their faith into their work without creating concerns and pushback for the separation of church and state?
Well, I think that the best practices that are part of the business world that have evolved, and let's face it, business ethics has evolved, just like all the other professions. I find them to be in tune with many of the gospel values. Treat other people fairly. Look out for those who are in want and who are vulnerable. Make sure that your workplace is life-giving, not only to the individual, but to the families. We try to do that with the Archdiocese. We're kind of a big business, too. We have 13,000 employees in the Archdiocese. And just one example, I decided when I came here, and I think I was pushed by my five sisters, to look at the whole business of parental leave. And it was at that time very minimal. I think you use vacation and sick time if you were expecting a child or the father to be on parental leave. I said, this won't do. If we are going to be really a model for how this should be done in any business or organization, we're going to have to do something different. So we put in 12 weeks for both the father and the mother. I think that those... I think businesses want to do the right thing, and a discussion with church, with faith leaders, can help them. But I'm not at all in any way disheartened by the challenges that might be out there in terms of church and state, because I find that business leaders do want to do the right thing. And that conversation, I think, is always good to have. So I'm hopeful, and I want to be a partner with others.
Thank you. This question is from Steve Fitzel, who's with St. Joan of Arc. His question is, Steve, you're out here, aren't you? Right over here. It is no secret that many pastors feel a parish school is a burden they do not want to deal with. Yet the Archdiocese recently raised many millions of dollars through To Teach Who Christ Is, which reflects a commitment to Catholic schools. What will you do to get reluctant priests on board with the Archdiocese's clear mission to preserve Catholic schools?
Well, the To Teach You Christ campaign was a great success. But it wasn't just for schools. It was also for parishes that needed deferred maintenance issues addressed, but also religious education for many children who are not part of our school system. And that's why I think there was a buy-in on the part of so many people. I am committed to Catholic school education. I'm a product of it. I know the great good that it can do. But I also do know that it is a burden for pastors, especially if they're looking for ways in which they're going to serve all the people in their parish and realize that a lot of their assets have to go to keeping the school open, while they also have to teach other children who are not part of the school system. I understand that tension that's there. I think my job is to not cajole them or criticize them, but to look for ways in which I can support them. But it's also the case, and we see this across the city with the public school system, we suffer from demographic changes. Populations erode in neighborhoods that were once there where the school was vibrant before. And so we have to make some hard choices. We have to be real about it. Huh? And so if a pastor comes to me and says, you know, we have full classes in 7th and 8th grade, but we're only getting 10 kids in the early grades, we have to pay attention to that. I'm respectful of the pastor's position. They have experience. And so I will listen to them, but also make sure that we help provide the resources so that we don't have deserts when it comes to Catholic school education. We're committed to that. It's part of the mission of the church. We're good at our education. Maybe a lot of you here are products of Catholic education, and you know the difference in, that it makes in the lives, especially of those who grow up poor. Our family had very little means. All of us got college education for the most part, and it is because we had a great education through a Catholic school system. I think it's the best weapon against poverty. And that's why I'm committed to it, not just for the mission of the church, but for the many people who aren't Catholic who come to our schools who benefit in terms of their entire life.
Thank you very much. Just curious, show of hands here, how many here are products of a Catholic education? Oh, quite a few. Excellent.
Some of the envelopes will be coming.
Yeah. The envelopes will be coming, and we have Sergeant of Arms. Before anybody leaves this room, we expect that envelope to be a little thicker than when you receive it. Thank you. This is from Eugene Guidis, who's with Denton's. Can you discuss how the popularity of Mass in the extraordinary form has helped or hindered the development of quality, reverent liturgy, and the current state of dialogue in the church, writ large?
Yes, I grew up with the what is now called the extraordinary form. Maybe you did as well. I know all the Latin prayers as an altar boy at the foot of the altar. I still can recite them. I have to admit, though, when I was maybe in fourth grade serving, I had no idea what I was saying. I think a parrot could have served Mass at that point. But there is a certain beauty to it, and some people are attracted, and that's why the church has allowed another extraordinary form. But I would also push back a little bit in saying that the experience of people on Sunday Mass at parishes with the new form of the liturgy is not life-giving, is not a moment in which they encounter the sacred. I think that people do come away nourished by the celebration of the Mass in the new rite. I've had both of them. I grew up in both of them. And I can tell you, if the Second Vatican Council didn't happen with the changes that were brought about in the life of the church, not only in terms of liturgy, but in terms of other issues, I probably would not have been a priest. It attracted me. And I'm here today as the Archbishop of Chicago, I think, because of the Second Vatican Council and the reforms that it brought about. It is life-giving to me.
What role do you foresee the changing role for nuns and sisters in the future of the church?
Well, I would say let's talk about women first of all. You know, I've always felt that the real issue with regard to people who have places in the church shouldn't be about ordination. It should be about getting people involved in decision making and giving them, empowering them to be a part, have a place at the table. I think that's what we need right now in the life of the church and what the Pope is calling for. He talks about an inverted pyramid. You know, a pyramid is at the top, you have the Pope, and then everybody else follows the bottom. He said, let's turn it upside down. He says, because we're all there at the top. If you turn it upside down, we're all the baptized. And the people who are below, at the base, are the ones who are supposed to be animating, allowing the baptism of people to be lived. It's a reminder that leadership is about having people understand who are in those positions of leadership that they don't serve by governing, but they govern by serving. And that's the real reform the Pope wants to bring about in the life of the church. That is part of the abuse crisis. Because if you get everybody on board and you have transparency and hold everybody accountable and not have a certain group of people who are in a class who are protected and privileged, then we're going to get it right. So I have worked for ways through my own councils in my hirings to have women at decision-making positions. I think we're the only archdiocese, the only diocese maybe in the world, that has created a chief operations officer, a COO position, and has a woman doing it. A woman is in charge of the operations of the archdiocese on a day-to-day basis, Betsy Bolin. And she does a terrific job, mother of two children. But I also have women around me to keep me from making some real bad mistakes. Please do not tell my five sisters I said that. But maybe it's because you grew up in a big family and you realize that not everybody has the full angle on the truth and what's right. You need different opinions. And I'm enriched by that. A leader should not be afraid of that diversity. Should embrace it.
Hey, we have time for a few more questions. I'll try to combine a couple of these. This is from Georgiana Torres Reyes with DePaul University. Very nice printing, by the way. She obviously went to Catholic grammar school, I'll tell you that. And Dennis Ryan. The question is, how can you please speak to the efforts that you and the church in Chicago are making to integrate the Latina community into the life of the church, and this public charge rule that will affect legal immigrants and their families?
A little over 45% of our Catholic population are Latino heritage, either newly arrivals or have been here for a time. All three of my new auxiliaries, while they're Anglo, are fluent in Spanish. I told the Holy Father when we talked about candidates that had to be a non-negotiable. We had to have that. So I think that is important. We're one of the untold stories and unsung hero groups are the amount of the number of Anglo priests who have learned another language, who are speaking Spanish. We're also blessed by, of course, a sizable Polish population here. I think that the real issue with regard to the Latino population is we shouldn't treat them as a burden but a blessing. I hope you have a chance sometime to go to a parish where there is a Spanish speaking mass. They're very vibrant. Maybe Our Lady of Guadalupe would be an opportunity for you to do that, huh? There is a deep faith and a piety and a spirituality that enriches us. So we shouldn't see our ministry as in some way just trying to keep up and tolerate or get by. But as seeing this diversity of culture that we have, particularly in the Latino population, as a great resource and gift, and something that's going to enrich our own spirituality. We're going to continue to reach out. I just went to the Encuentro, the fifth Encuentro down in Texas, which was a national moment to look at how we're dealing with Hispanic ministry. And that group that represented the Archdiocese is going to meet with me in December to come up with some recommendations for us to move forward in this. I think we're going to make some headway in further. We're always growing on that. With regard to the whole business of immigrants coming into this country, we need an honest debate about the great contribution that new immigrants make to our country. I walked through the kitchen beforehand to greet the people who were prepared our food. Many of them are immigrants, are Latinos. They contribute much to our society, not only in the workforce, but in terms of their dedication to families, their sense of patriotism. How many have entered into our military or on our police force, as Officer Jimenez, who died tragically a week ago yesterday, proves for us. They're a part of our life here, and it's a life that's enriched because they are.
We have two last questions, Your Eminence. This is from City Club member Leslie Wilson. Leslie, where are you? Back there, 50-yard line seat in the upper deck. Her question is, how has Chicago become a host to and furthered your unique ministry?
I would have to take the rest of the day to talk about that. One of the things that people ask me, what's it like to be the Archbishop of Chicago? And I said, the first thing that impresses me is that from the day I arrived, I got the feeling that people wanted me to succeed, that there was a sense of a real support, that they loved the church. They wanted, even if they weren't Catholic, they saw the importance of it. So I come in with that aspect. We have troubles. We have real serious problems we have to deal with. But the goodwill out there, it really buoys me, and that helps me. I don't think I've ever had that before. I was out in South Dakota, where we had a very small Catholic population, one-third of them being Native Americans, and out in the West Coast and in Spokane, again, we were a minority. But here, the footprint of the church is so large in institutions and the presence of people that it really does give me a sense that I have to be not just caring about what goes on in the church, but also this city. I have to be a partner with elected officials in business and labor and everyone else. And that really has, I've had to grow up in that way. I've had to look at how I do my ministry differently because there are so many willing partners out there who want the best. Whether it deals with violence on our streets or our school system in educating young people, the ways in which we take care of the people who are on the streets, who are homeless, those who are looking for employment, but also the suffering that comes when violence strikes a neighborhood or a police force. Yesterday was an opportunity. We saw it as not only elected officials and the police and so many other citizens through presence there or on TV came together as one city and said, we have to own this tragedy. All of us are impoverished by it, but we also have responsibility for taking the next step ahead. And so that is what impresses me about being here. That's uniquely different. It's not that I'm uniquely different. It's that the Archdiocese in Chicago is uniquely different, and so I've had to make sure that what I do fits into and leverages that great gift that Chicago brings.
Our final question is from a former federal prosecutor. It gets my attention. City Club member Dwayne Deskins. Dwayne, where are you? Oh, over there. Okay.
The question is, many faithful worry that the church may go the way of Sears. Great catalog and brick and mortar stores. Do you think about this? What is next?
Well, I think that any institution, any organization, if it doesn't reform and grow, it's going to die. And that's what we're doing with Renew My Church. We're organizing our parishes into groupings to talk about the future of how the church is going to operate in various localities, and being honest with people about things such as deferred maintenance to personnel going forward that we have to staff our parishes, to finances and debt. We really need to be honest with our people where we stand. Yeah, there are some real challenges and headwinds ahead, but I think that people are willing to look at a situation and move forward. But we don't want to be an organization that just goes off into the sunset because we weren't willing to adapt and change. We need serious reform. But at the heart of the reform, which we're doing in Renew My Church, and I think the Pope is doing, is to make sure that we are in this together, and we respect the baptism of every Catholic to be a part of what's going on. This business of not giving people facts of where we are with regard to abuse or where we are in terms of the structural viability or non-viability of a parish in the archdiocese, those days are over. We have to be honest about that. But I believe that people want us to grow and reform. I'm not afraid of that. You know, Cardinal Mundelein built some wonderful buildings. He was a great builder. I'm not going to build any big buildings. But maybe if I can make a contribution to building the people, the faith communities that we have to be strong and vibrant and sustainable long-term, then maybe that's the contribution that our time together would result in. So unless you're willing to change and reform and deal with the hard structural issues, you are going to just go off into the sunset. I don't want to be a part of that. I wasn't ordained 43 years ago, to be part of a sinking ship. And I think that comes from my original reason to say yes to a vocation to serve as a priest. I think the church is vibrant, has a great impact on the lives of people, as it has mine, and society. And we have to roll up our sleeves and get to work.